Hidalgo and Valina Brigley are being interviewed by Renee Garalick for Concord's Oral History Program. The interview is taking place at their home on Sudbury Road on February 8, 1981. Mr. Brigley is 61 years old and Ms. Brigley is 70. We will begin with Hidalgo Brigley, who was present when the attack on Pearl Harbor occurred on December 7, 1941. The event represents one of such historical magnitude and of such a shattering impact that people of that era will remember where they were and what they were doing at that time. Since you were at Pearl Harbor aboard a minesweeper the morning of the attack, you are a first-hand eyewitness to this event. Would you recall how you happened to be at Pearl Harbor at the time and the events that occurred on that shattering day?
I was just over 20 years old when I enlisted in the Navy in 1939, believing that eventually the United States was going to go to war in Europe. After boot training at Newport, Rhode Island, I was assigned to the USS Perry, a destroyer minesweeper, stationed at San Diego, California. In April 1940, the fleet went off on maneuvers for 6 weeks. Remembering the night I entered Pearl Harbor after maneuvers, the sight of over 100 ships with their searchlights on was just something to see. Now, in May of 1940, the fleet received orders to remain at Pearl Harbor indefinitely. Ironically, 6 months before the attack, the Pacific Fleet was informed to have ammunition ready beside all guns. On December 5th, 1941, we received orders to return to the States on December 8th. The attack on Pearl Harbor changed all that. After a luscious breakfast of hash and soft-boiled eggs, I went on watch at 7:50 a.m. for the 8 to 12 o'clock shift. I happened to hear some planes overhead. The first two planes, I thought, had practiced bombs. But when the third plane hit the hangar, I knew something was wrong. Then I saw the orange ball designating the Japanese symbol of the rising sun on the plane. Then all hell broke loose. Anchored on the Pearl City side of the Naval Air Station, Port Island, you could see in every direction. Eventually, a total of 353 Japanese planes were to come, with 180 arriving in the first wave from 7:55 to 8:40 a.m., consisting of fighters, torpedo planes, and high bombers. We had thought it was all over, but at 8:45 a.m., a second wave of 173 more planes came in. Since it was a Sunday, many men were off on liberty, and none of the ships had a full complement. To fight back, we used what we had available: pistols, guns. My job was to be a first loader on the 4-inch mounted guns that really could not be used for aircraft. The final blow was all over at 9:45 a.m. If anybody said they weren't scared, they are lying. It was 1 hour and 50 minutes of hell. the USS Medusa, I say, was the first ship to fire at the Japanese. She was two ships away from us. Our ship was third from the last ship out of the harbor, and the first ship back into sweep. And there was approximately 4 to 5 inches of oil on the water in the harbor to clean. All the ships were lined up, proving ineffective for firing all guns. But who would think the Japanese would come 6,000 miles and hit us? In addition to their planes, the Japanese also had 5 subs which carried midget subs. The U.S. did not have a carrier at Pearl Harbor when the attack occurred. Though our carriers were out, they never chased the Japanese, and we never understood why. The USS Nevada, a battleship, started out after the Japanese. Fortunately, the skipper beached her when she became damaged and the channel was left open. If the Japanese had waited till the Nevada got into the channel before striking, she would have blocked the whole harbor. Extensive total damage occurred to the following ships. The Arizona was sunk when a bomb exploded, and to this day, 1,177 sailors and Marines are entombed. The Oklahoma was overturned. The California sunk straight down. The Utah, a converted battleship with 54 men aboard, was completely lost, and the men are still entombed. The total Americans killed were 2,335, and 1,143 were wounded. 68 civilians were killed and 35 wounded. The Navy lost 2,008 men, the Army 218, and the Marines 109. The Army lost 96 aircraft with 128 damaged. The Navy lost 92 aircraft with 31 damaged. The Japanese losses were 29 planes, 1 large submarine, and 5 midget subs. In manpower, they only lost 55 airmen and 9 men on the midget subs.
There is a reunion held for the survivors of Pearl Harbor, and that was begun in 1966, the reunion?
Yes, and I attended the first reunion in 1971, and then again in 1976. And I expect to attend the one in 1981 for the 40th anniversary. The sad part is when you go over to the Arizona Memorial to pay respects to the 1,177 sailors and Marines in June.
Your neighborhood in Concord growing up was known as the area behind the depot, and that was home for many Italian families as well as your own. Would you like to comment what it was like coming to Concord? You were very, very young then, Felina.
Yes, I was born in Italy in a small town near Modena and Bologna, northern Italy. 1914, I came to this country at the age of 3. Having never seen snow, when I stepped off the train in Concord, the conductor was taking me off, and I just lifted my feet up because I didn't want to step into this white stuff. And at that time, in order for immigrants to come to this country, you had to have a sponsor or someone to come to. My father had come earlier. He came when I was only 9 months old, in 1911. And so he had called us. In those days, it was mighty hard. He had to find a place to live, find work, pay his rent, send money to my mother for my sister and I, and at the same time save passage for the 3 of us to come. Unfortunately, my sister had left behind, which is another sad story. The fare for me was $10. We lived at that time on Belknap Street at the end of what was called Brennan's Block, just four-room house. My father had everything all set for my mother too. She said it was like a queen when she came here, because we came from a very poor immigrant family. We were among many Italians and Irish who had settled pretty much in what we call Baca Vigo. We went to St. Bernard's Church. There was no way of getting anywhere except by walking in those days. I remember the trolley cars that came through town, Subway Road, Thorough Street, up Main Street, up as far as Mainland. I always remember that. This was way, way back. We did, well, holidays. November 11th was always very familiar to me because on that day, it was a saint's day, St. Joseph's Day. It just never passed without having roasted chestnuts and playing games, cards, what we call tombola, which is now bingo in America. Christenings was another big event that the Italians always had, and everybody was invited. And I can remember my christening, because I was christened for the second time with my sister and my brother. And my father said, well, as long as we're christening those two, let's put Felina in, because she was christened in Italy, but that, fortunately for me, it was recorded down here. I can remember...
Was it Delgo?
No, it wasn't. It was my sister Mary and my brother Conrad.
I see.
And I can remember walking down to church, of course, because I was about 6 years old, 7. But what I remember of the party most, my mother had baked a huge pan of baked apples with the stems still on them. And all the children, of course, would go and get one of these apples and eat it. I remember very plainly. The men folks always had Sundays and evenings through the summer always had bocce games and horseshoes, which were done with the real horseshoes that we got at Johnny Moreau's blacksmith shop. Then I can remember coming home from school one day. It was either the first or second grade on Belknap Street, and go up at the end of the street. Oh, it was so exciting. The circus had come. So we all had to go up and see that. Unfortunately, when we got back to school, it was 3:15. We got out at 3:30. This later on, they had a swimming hole up at the end of Elsinore Street and Belknap Street, where the boys his age went. That was quite a bit older then. When we were still on Cottage Lane, I remember animals coming, being transported from one place to another, and they used to put them on the sidetrack, mostly cows. And as you know, cows had to be milked. So they would ask the neighborhood people to bring kettles and things, so they milked the cows, so we got the cow with the milk. In the winter, very severe. I don't ever remember snow plows when I was a little girl, ever. But they had ponies, so they went over the snow. The town had them, and we used to just hop them and go off to school and go as they went down the street.
These were horse-drawn?
Yes, horse-drawn ponies. Mm-hmm. I can remember the snow being so deep on the roof on Cottage Lane at one time. I can remember that the snow on the roof was just as deep as it was on the ground. We had, coming from a poor family, we really had very, very little. And I wanted a sled so badly. But my father said, well, it just wasn't the money for it. So one day, he came upstairs, having been downstairs for long, many nights, And he said, well, here's your sled, which he had made for me out of beef ribs he had brought home from the butcher's. Well, I was so embarrassed, I wouldn't think of taking that sled. So he said, all right, don't. Sundays, we always went down the Shattuck Road because the river overflowed, and there was always skating there. And he goes down with this sled, and I stay way behind. I wouldn't even let them know that he was my father. He gets down there, and he sits on this sled with his two poles, and he had a ball, and every skater hung onto him. That was wonderful. That was my sled. Then there were the days of Dr. Titcomb. Many people in Concord know Dr. Titcomb. One of the famous stories of Dr. Titcomb is that he had taken my father to the hospital to have his appendix out. Well, they had given him so much ether and he couldn't get to sleep. He heard one of the nurses say, well, don't give him any more, he'll die of too much ether. But he made one big flash, he broke the straps in the operating table and he went home.
Oh, my.
He went in to get his pants and his coat and shirt and shoes and the rest of his clothes under his arm. And he comes down by the railroad track, and Dr. Titcomb passes him and never even picked him up.
Did he ever have his appendix out?
Dr. Titcomb came in the next morning to see him bright and early. My father was having his breakfast. He said, where do you think you're going, Jerry? He says, I'm going to work. Oh, he says, oh, no. He said, you could have an operation. He says, not by you people. You're going to kill me. So he died at the age of, what was it, 67?
68.
And with his appendix still in. But he was a great friend of my father's, nevertheless. My father worked at that time for Higginson's, which is where John Adams' estate is now, Baker Bridge, just beyond Lake Walden. And one day when my father was coming home from work, he had a bicycle, that's all he ever rode on, but that day he couldn't use a bike because we had so much snow. He had a snow shovel with him. He had walked down as far as Walden Pond when behind him comes Dr. Titcomb in his horse and buggy. They came upon a big drift, couldn't get through. So he said, Jerry, what am I ever going to do? So my father said, well, you unhitch the horse and I will shovel a path for the horse to get through. You give him a good whack, and when you get home, he'll be in the barn. But he'd have to leave his wagon there, which is what they did. So my father walked along with him and shoveled away until he got home, which was on Sudbury Road. There was a horse in the barn. I always remember that story of my father's. Well, let's see. Then they had the days of when the express train used to come through, and they used to hang a mail bag, and this arm would come out and just snip it right off. Once in a while it missed, but not too often. We had in those days milk being delivered very early in the morning. In those cold days, it would get so frozen that the cream would be way up off the top. And the first one out to get the milk would try to get that, thinking it was ice cream.
That was before homogenized milk.
Before homogenized rice. And my father was a gardener all his life for the wealthy people of Concord. And in the early days, they took care of the furnaces because everything was coal furnaces. They kept going and stoked them morning and night, real early morning. They really worked awfully hard. The horse and buggy days, the McManuses had a horse and buggy taxi service. That's where the apothecary shop now is.
On Thorough Street.
On Thorough Street, yes.
And you attended Americanization classes,
yes,
to learn English?
I wasn't able to continue school. Being the oldest of an immigrant family, we were all that way and had to stay home to help. So I was working with the Hosmers at the time, and I went for 7 or 8 years without missing a single night. And I took an English course that the state supplied, so that, you know, my English would be all right. And that was a lot of fun, and many of the people in Concord were offered their parole. And now the Daughters of the American Revolution presented each one of the women who became American citizens with an American flower. Mrs. Hosmer entertained a group at luncheon or tea. She had brought us 1 year, I remember, at the Antiquarian House. And Mrs. Edward James at that time always had a party for the Americanization classes. And we used to put on skits about the immigrants, about coming to this country and being the melting pot of everything. And we used to have a real full house.
Well, that's wonderful. And Dallow, you, like many other boys, delivered newspapers as a way of earning money?
Oh, yes. Back in the early days of the 1930s, I used to deliver 50 or 60 newspapers every morning and evening. Back in those days, the price of the paper was 2 cents, but the people paid 3 cents, and I got 1 cent for delivering each paper delivered.
Valina, you worked for a Dr. Johnston who had, for a long time, served in Concord.
Yes. I came to Dr. Johnston February 1st, 1932, and lived with him until with them until he retired and went to Maine. He has since returned and lives in Acton. Wonderful family, just never could do enough. I can remember one day Mrs. Johnston wasn't feeling well, and she asked if I could help out with some of the bookkeeping and the posting. And I came across one item of Dr. Johnston's, and he'd gone to Littleton to make a call. And I said to him, "Dr. Johnston, I think you've made a mistake on this. Did you mean to charge $1 when you saw Mr. and Mrs. and 5 children? "Oh," he said, "yes, just leave it at $1, he said. "They looked like a poor family." That was the type of a man he was. I also will always remember that at Christmas time, when he had very sick people at the hospital, poor people, always thinking of the poor people, he had Mrs. Johnston make out the bill and mark it paid in full, Merry Christmas. And he would bring it up there and hand it to them. If it was the children, he'd say, "Will you please hand this to your parents when they come in?" That was done that nobody knew about.
And how long did you work for him?
I worked for him until he retired, which was September of 1964. But I am still connected with them. So actually, I have known them for 49 years.
That's beautiful. I'm going to have you close with a story that indicates some of Concord's humor, and that is the story of Emil Thorpe.
Well, I have 2 stories of Emil Thorpe. One is when he was peddling fish with the horse and wagon on Hubbard Street. And in those days, they had the hitching post where they hitched the horse, and he had forgotten to hitch it that day. And the horse started to move, so he started to whip it. And this woman called out and says, "Oh, Emmy, Emmy, have you no mercy?" He says, "No, ma'am, only caught and had it." Another time, when the police department was at the town hall, Richardson's drugstore, this is when Charlie Voigt was there, there was a man there that was giving them a bit of trouble. So they said, "If you don't leave, we're going to have to call the police." So they called the police, and who comes but Emmy? So he went in and had to take him away. Halfway down, near where the watering trough is now, the man said to Emmy, he said, "Oh, wait," he says, "I left my coat. I've got to go back and get my coat." And Emmy says, "Oh, no, you don't. You wait here, and I'll go back and get it."
Well, thank you. I believe you're the first brother and sister combination interview we've had so far.
Well, then another nice thing about Emmelthorpe, he used to be the policeman every Sunday morning at Trinity Church on Elm Street when I was with the Hosmers, which is just across the street. And in those days, we had snow, you know, knee-deep all the time. And while the service was going on, I used to go out to Emmy with a tray of a cup of coffee and cream and sugar and either a donut or something in the middle of the service. So it's a nice way to end it.
Oh, sure. And when you say the Hosmers, you mean Beeb Hosmer,
yes,
and Gladys Hosmer.
Yes,
mm-hmm.
Yes. Mm-hmm.
Thank you.
I lived with them for 5 years and 3 months, and then the Depression came, and she said, I cannot cut your pay, so I want you to go out and get another job.